The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome to the program today Gilbert King. Hello, Gilbert.
Hi, great to be here.
Gilbert, you got a new book out. It's called Beneath a Ruthless Sun, a true story of violence, race, and justice lost and found. And this is clearly an outgrowth from your previous book, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of how I found it. I was doing a book talk down in Lake County, and an old deputy came up to me, basically said, you know, you got your book right, but you didn't get the whole story. There's more down here. And he started telling me the story of Jesse Daniels. And you know, the way he framed it, he basically said, you know, we framed this kid. You know, he's speaking for the department. And he goes, that was just something that never set with me. And it haunted him for decades. And he wanted to talk about it. And he said, nobody's going to talk to you about this case. It's so sensitive. And there's still people around. And sure enough, you know, he told me what happened. And I spoke with some other people. And then I started filing Freedom of Information Act requests. And the more I found out about it, I originally was just going to do an article about it, maybe just a follow-up. But, you know, the more and more I found out about it, I said, this is a book in itself.
You just said Lake County. Some of our listeners are probably thinking, Lake County, there's probably 50 Lake Counties in the U.S. Which state are you talking about?
Yeah, this is down in Florida. Like, it's true. They're all over the place. I should have known that. But Florida is, you know, where the last book took place, Devil in the Grove. So I'm returning to that stomping ground, I guess you could say.
Well, even though we're in Dayton, Ohio, there's probably two or three people out there that haven't read your previous book, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But in this one, I assume you're right now you're in Daytona Beach. Is that right?
Exactly, yeah.
Aren't you just down the road from Lake County? How far away are you?
Oh, it's probably about 45 minutes away, maybe an hour. Uh-huh. So it's nearby. I'm doing a bunch of talks in the area, and so I'll be going to Lake County later today.
That must be very interesting because this is recent history, isn't it? I mean, it's set in the 1950s and onward. That's just like yesterday.
Yeah, it really isn't that far. I mean, especially with this book in particular, because I was interviewing people who were involved in the case. And so it seems like a long time ago based on how antiquated the criminal justice system is. But, you know, people are still alive. People live through it. And it is kind of shocking that, you know, I'm talking to people, including the main person in the book, Jesse Daniels himself, is in Daytona Beach.
Explain how a Supreme Court decision that occurred a few years before this story begins. Explain how this impacted the story.
Yeah, this is something I really wasn't aware of until I started really researching it. But Brown versus Board was the, you know, unanimous Supreme Court decision, landmark civil rights case, the desegregation of the public schools. And what we really, really need to understand when you look at a case like this is how the South reacted to Brown versus Board. I mean, in many places in the South, this was seen as an interfering in a way of lifestyle that was, you know, ingrained in the Southern life. And all of a sudden, now they're forcing desegregation. The reaction was pretty swift and pretty violent in a lot of ways. I mean, you had all of a sudden the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan, which had been laying mostly dormant for quite some time. You had these white citizen councils popping up, 300,000 members across 11 states. And, you know, they were, Thurgood Marshall called them the Uptown Klan. These were like respectable people in communities who were opposed to desegregation. And then they fought it very hard. And so really understanding how race and the reaction to this Supreme Court decision in the late 1950s just impacted everything from political to social to economic. I mean, it was a swift reaction.
Gilbert King joins me on the program. His new book is Beneath a Ruthless Sun, a true story of violence, race, and justice lost and found. And let's talk about this county and this sheriff that essentially is running the county.
Yeah, I mean, there was no more powerful person in Lake County, Florida. I mean, once he was elected in 1944, He was answerable to, only to the electorate, and he was so powerful that judges, prosecutors, everybody just kind of buckled under him. He was the law of the land, and he had a reign that was 28 years long. He was elected 7 times as sheriff. After the Groveland case, I mean, he shot the 2 Groveland boys on the side of the road because he didn't like the Supreme Court's decision to overturn the trial. So he took the law into his own hands and decided to execute the Groveland boys. After he did that, there were people around the country that would say, well, that's going to be the end of his political career. He just can't execute people and take the law into his own hands. In fact, he was elected 6 more times after that. And you know, he went on record saying, I don't think that hurt me one bit. Probably helped me. So that was sort of his reputation. He was he was proud of the fact that he was absolutely racist and ran the county in, according to law and order, the way he saw fit, which included, you know, debt slavery, brutality, murders. I mean, he ruled over all of it. And so I don't think there's too many more sheriffs out there in the country that had this kind of reputation. Some of them were tough law and order types, but you know, Willis McCall was killing people.
During your research, you talked to somebody who told you that you thought that he thought that Sheriff McCall was responsible for at least 25 or 30 murders.
Yeah, I mean, and that was one thing that showed up in an FBI document, too, some of the informants who were talking to the FBI. And, you know, I would come across these cases. They were just, you know, barely investigated. There's just no evidence against them. But, you know, him just shooting people randomly, running people over with his car. You know, they explained away, you know, oh, it was dark and it was rainy and the sheriff lost control of his vehicle. But, you know, there's some of these reports of people who survived this. Who said, and this was totally intentional. He became an enemy of me, and he was trying to kill me. I talked to one gentleman who told me about a black man who had been shot on the street, and he said they made it look like the other guy had a gun and was trying to kill the sheriff, but it was just McCall just shot him. And there were just cases like this that would pop up, and the FBI would investigate, but they just went nowhere. But you know, he was a very violent man.
Gilbert, you begin your story telling us about an innocent young man. He's 17, and I guess you could say he's a little bit slow. And he's your main man in the story, and I think a lot of readers will be surprised when they get to the end of the story and discover that he's still around.
Yeah, I mean, and that was the thing. I talked to him half a dozen times over the last 5 years, and you know, he served 14 years at Chattahoochee. And I say served, he was committed to this horrible mental institute, but it was basically like a prison. You know, you never had any counseling. Or I think over his 14 years, he'd seen a doctor 8 times. So it wasn't really an extensive oversight. And I asked him, I said, you know, are you bitter about this? And he said, yes, I lost all my childhood. And it was interesting because he went into Chattahoochee as a 19-year-old. And I remember thinking, well, your childhood. But doctors had said he had the mind of a 10-year-old. And so in his mind, because of his mental disability, he lost his whole childhood being sent to this horrible institution and, you know, committed basically against his will. Basically, the judges just signed a signature saying he's insane and unable to defend himself. And so that was what they were able to do as a tool of law enforcement, was just if they didn't have a good case, they could just send you to a mental institute. And that's what happened to this kid.
Gilbert, explain the complicated story of how this happened.
Right. And this is the part of it that's just hard to believe. I mean, if you put this in a novel, I think people wouldn't really know what to do with it. It just sounds so strange. But there was a wealthy wife of a citrus baron, a 31-year-old woman named Blanche Bosanquet Knowles. And her husband was away, allegedly on business, one night in December of 1957. And she reported that she'd been sexually assaulted in her home where her 3 children were sleeping. And so she described her attacker as an African-American with bushy hair, and reported it, and the deputies rounded up 24 black men in this small town of Okahumka, kept them in jail, and started narrowing down the suspects until they got to the nephew of the civil rights activist in this part of Lake County, and he's their suspect. And then something really strange happens. The husband comes home from his alleged business trip and basically says, I can't have it out there that a black man raped my wife. What are we going to do about it? And at that point, some of the powers that be, the very powerful people in Lake County, get together and they release the African-American suspect and arrest a white Jesse Daniels, a 19-year-old mentally disabled youth, and basically frame him for this murder. And the reporter in the story, Mabel Norris Reese, is under the impression that this Jesse Daniels was framed because it would have been more acceptable for the victim to have been sexually assaulted by a white person rather than a black person.
You have clear-cut villains and heroes in this story. And then you have people that kind of swing between. In fact, this law enforcement officer who first put you onto the story, he started off being one of the perpetrators in a way, didn't he?
Well, I mean, that's the million-dollar question. I mean, he was obviously knew that this kid was framed. And I think he just didn't speak out about it because he was a young deputy, and that was just the way things were done. And it bothered him so much so that 2 years later, in 1960, these two African-Americans had been falsely accused of rape and convicted on manufactured evidence. And they were just a few days away from the electric chair, and this deputy just had enough, and he turned them in and reported that the evidence had been manufactured. And the FBI did an investigation. They did a stay of execution. And the FBI concluded that the evidence was manufactured in one of the deputy's backyard, not at the crime scene. And so that was the end of, you know, Evie Griffin's law enforcement career. He was done. You couldn't cross the sheriff and turn in deputies for doing this kind of thing. But, you know, he was adamant about it. You know, he just said it wasn't necessary. It was a wrong thing to do. And, you know, and it had been a pattern in Lake County of just manufacturing evidence against African-Americans in death penalty cases. They tried it in Groveland, and they tried it in 1960. And it was exactly what Jesse Daniels went through.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. My guest is Gilbert King. We're talking about his new book, Beneath a Ruthless Sun, and we'll continue our conversation right after this. This is the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to have on the program today Gilbert King. His new book is Beneath a Ruthless Sun, a true story of violence, race, and justice lost and found. And this tragedy, in large part, of this young man's incarceration for all these years in a mental institution, a horrifying place, all those years spent locked away just because someone didn't want the perception that his wife had been raped by a black man. This is just so horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the most horrible things because, you know, really, it's kind of the reverse of what you think. And Willis McCall, when he was first presented with this scenario, he was against it. One of the informants said, no, he was ready to hang a black man. That was what he was good at. And so when they came to him with this proposition that they needed a white person, he really couldn't understand it at first. But then, you know, there were powerful people in town, and he knew where the power base was, and so he made it happen. But, you know, there's also a state attorney who was very much involved in this, and, you know, he was very good friends with the victim and the victim's husband. And so he was really the one that facilitated. He was the prosecutor. And, you know, the conspiracy that they put together is just kind of remarkable. They got, you know, they even hired Jesse's attorney, who was a former state attorney, and he was in on it too. And so it just, you could see how a kid with no money, his parents, you know, were destitute and living in poverty, had no way to defend himself. And, you know, it was just a very easy target. And I think that's why they, you know, picked Jesse Daniels. He was one of the disposable people.
They just didn't care about him. They didn't care what happened to him and the horror that his life had become, this innocent kid. And his mother never gave up. And Neither did this reporter, this newspaper publisher in that little town, and she's really the big hero in this story.
Yeah, she really is. I mean, I really love this story because sometimes when I write about these 1940s and 1950s stories, the women are kind of marginalized and off to the side, and it's the husbands who are doing everything or the men involved. In this case, it was really driven by two women. Mabel Norris Reese was this reporter who had a long history with Sheriff Willis McCall. And, you know, when she started writing about, you know, Brown versus Board and urging, like, sensibility and a patience and a gradual desegregation, she was attacked in the community. She had a cross burned in her yard. She had bombs thrown at her house. They poisoned her dog. I mean, the Klan was after her. And eventually they ran her out of town. They just ruined her newspaper. And Willis McCall personally threatened all the advertisers, saying don't advertise in that newspaper anymore. And they drove her out of town. She had no choice because she was ruined economically. But she went about, you know, 50 miles away to Daytona Beach and got a job as a newspaper reporter for the Daytona Beach News Journal. And she stayed on top of this story. And she just kept writing about it. Nobody else was writing about it. But she was determined. And, you know, she knew that Jesse was framed. And she worked up this friendship with Jesse's mother, who was investigating the case on her own. And I think that was one of the really, I think, most inspiring parts is Jesse's mother, Pearl, really had no resources. All she could do was write letters. And she wrote to the governor. She wrote to J. Edgar Hoover many times, urging him. In fact, Hoover started writing back to her, you know, this poor mother living in Florida. He started giving her legal advice. And Pearl just said, nope, I can't do. They're all in on this conspiracy, and I need help from you. I need the federal help. And I think she was just such a nuisance that J. Edgar Hoover just ultimately said, oh, fine, open up a civil rights investigation. And he did. And that was really what started to turn the tide in this case, was that civil rights investigation.
And we also have, you keep mentioning the Ku Klux Klan, we have a sheriff who apparently was leading the Klan in his community. He was a big Klan guy.
Right. And, that was not unusual. The lines in law enforcement and the Klan were very much blurred. The Orlando, Orange County sheriff, was openly in the Klan. He would lead the Klan parades. Sheriff Dave Starr, very, very flamboyant sheriff. Willis McCall was a little bit more behind the scenes. He didn't really like it known that he was in the Klan, but there was all sorts of FBI informants that would describe the meetings and how Willis McCall came in there and gave them advice about how to talk to the FBI and what to say and what not to say. And he did a lot of things that he couldn't through law enforcement, through the Klan. And so, you know, those lines were seriously blurred, especially in Lake County, where you had some of the deputies and sheriffs that were in the Klan making sure things were done the right way.
And these guys never stopped. Anytime they saw someone trying to help out Jesse or some kind of way that their secrets were going to be revealed, they were on it. They never gave up, and they just had this colossal arrogance. You've got the sheriff who finally, years later, is being brought to trial, and one of the observers in the courtroom, I think it was your police officer friend, said, hey, he obviously has a gun in his pocket, and he walked right into the court with it.
Right. I mean, it was just like his excuse was, that's just as common as me as putting my wallet in my pocket. He walked into the court. He's facing a felony charge, and nobody searched him because he was the sheriff of Lake County. They just let him right in, and he has a gun, and he's at the table, and one of the deputies spots it, and they, sure enough, he pulls it out. He says, I always carry this thing. It was just, you know, that kind of bizarre trial. Sheriff Willis McCall up on a murder charge, and he basically was laughing in the courtroom, reading the comics. He was not worried at all, and it took the jury about an hour to acquit him, even though there was pretty serious eyewitness testimony that he had kicked to death a prisoner in one of the cells.
Apparently his 16-year-old daughter-in-law wasn't concerned about being searched either.
Yeah, that's another thing. I don't know how she got in there with, but she got arrested and turned over to the authorities for carrying a gun in the courtroom too. So you had the whole family was packing heat, apparently.
It's not funny. I don't know why I'm chuckling.
No,
Mike,
it's just strange.
Yeah. Gilbert, Jesse finally does get out, and it's a miracle. It's really a miracle, and a big part of that was an attorney who you had extensive contact with.
Yeah, exactly. That was one of the great benefits is that he was a young attorney just out of law school. And so once I started researching this, I found that he was still alive. He was a retired judge living in Daytona Beach. And I started contacting him, and he said, I mean, his response to me was, it's about time. I goes, this is the most important case I've ever been involved with in my career. And I kept waiting for someone to write about it. So, you know, Richard Graham was able to sort of, not only did I have all the documents and all the hearings and transcripts and everything, but I had him just reminding me what it was like and the personal side of taking a case like this and going up against these very dangerous Lake County types. He was able to add a lot of color and description and remembered it very clearly. And so he was a great benefit to just have, and ultimately, I sort of facilitated a reunion between him and Jesse Daniels. They hadn't seen each other in about 45 years, even though they were living in the same town. And it was pretty powerful because I took Richard Graham into the church to meet Jesse, and I wasn't really sure if Jesse would recognize him after all this time. And Jesse was very quiet, and it looked like he didn't. And then all of a sudden he said to Richard Graham, "Do you still have that sweet little blue sports car?"
Uh-huh.
And Richard Graham's face just lit up because he said, "Oh, you do remember me."
Oh.
It was just the sweetest thing.
You're listening to the Book Nook. My guest is Gilbert King. He's out on book tour right now for Beneath a Ruthless Sun, A True Story of Violence, Race, and Justice Lost and Found. And you can meet him. He is coming to our area for book signing. He'll be at Books and Company in Dayton and Beaver Creek on Wednesday evening, May 23rd at 7 p.m., talking about the book and signing copies of it. And most of his book tour is in Florida. He's hitting a number of locations in Florida. And then here's Dayton, Ohio on here. And explain, you have a fondness for Dayton for some reason. Now, why is that?
Oh, I certainly do. I've been coming for the last 5 years to the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, and I've met so many great friends, you know, including Sharon Rabb, who runs it. But just over the years, I've just met so many great Dayton people. One of the greatest, I think, reading communities I've ever encountered anywhere in the country. People just take books and reading so seriously in Dayton, and it's just an absolute pleasure for writers to come out there and just be a part of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize. Everyone's jealous. I'm telling you, everybody wants to get out there because they've heard such great things from all the writers who have come out here. What a special weekend it is with the panels and the awards dinner. So I do have a really strong connection. I feel like this is my home away from home in a lot of ways.
Are you going to tell us why you came here the first time?
The first time I came, I was the runner-up for nonfiction for the Dayton Literary Peace Prize. And then they ask you back the next year to be a presenter for next year's runner-up. And then apparently just certain people couldn't make it, and they asked me to fill in. I just became kind of the stalwart that keeps showing up every year. And I said, hey, I'll come out as long as you'll have me. And last year I actually hosted the awards dinner, which was really fun. So I'm going to be back in Dayton whenever they'll have me.
Tell our listeners and readers about that book that brought you here, Devil in the Grove.
Yeah, well, this is a story that I've been working on for, I think it took me about 5 years, and it was published in 2012, and kind of quietly published. Didn't get a lot of reviews, didn't get a lot of notice, definitely didn't sell very well. And then all out of the blue, in April of 2013, I got a text message on my phone, and it had two words, "Dude, Pulitzer." And I clicked the link, and I remember seeing that Adam Johnson has just been awarded the Pulitzer Prize for his novel, Orphan Master's Son. And I had been telling everybody, all my friends, to read this book. I thought it was a great novel. So I thought that's what I got the text about. Adam just won the Pulitzer. But then the next sentence in the article said, "For nonfiction, Gilbert King's Devil in the Grove." And I actually thought it was a practical joke because I had no idea that I was nominated or anything like that. And then right after I put the phone down, it just started pinging like crazy, and I realized this is not a joke. This must have really happened. But this is a story of Thurgood Marshall came down to Florida in the late 1940s and took on this To Kill a Mockingbird case. Four African-Americans falsely accused of rape. And, you know, Sheriff Willis McCall was leading the investigation. And you know, they had a trial. The trial was basically a travesty of justice. And then Marshall came in and took it to the U.S. Supreme Court and got it overturned. And I guess the case really takes a strange turn when Willis McCall, on the eve of the retrial, goes up to Rayford State Prison, picks up the Groveland boys, handcuffs them, drives them back, and then takes a little detour down a side clay road and decides he's going to execute the Groveland boys. And so that was just this unbelievable moment in legal history that really nobody was aware of. I mean, I still come down to Florida and talk to people who grew up in Lake County and whose, you know, father was a witness in the trial, and they had no idea that this had happened. And it's just kind of a remarkable thing that for some reason this case should have been more well known based on how much violence there was. Four people were killed in the middle of the trial. And basically it's forgotten in the history books. So it's I think it's about Florida in a lot of ways. People didn't know how to look at Florida. It was kind of perceived as south of the south. Mm. It wasn't really the Cotton Belt South that people were used to hearing about these civil rights cases. So the fact that it happened in Florida, I think it just fell off the radar. And, you know, fortunately I was able to get just about every single record I could possibly that existed and sort of shine a new light on this case.
So Sheriff Willis McCall was the villain in your previous book as well. And this is a guy who, while he lost his office as sheriff and a lot of his power, he never really paid any kind of price, did he, for his crimes?
No, he really did not. He liked to brag that he'd been investigated 49 times on civil rights charges and beat every one of them. And, you know, he had some line. He goes, my hide is like a gator skin. You can stick a needle in, but it'll only bend. Mm. And he just was very adamant about the fact that he was never going to get caught. And even when they had, you know, pretty good evidence against him for murder, including witnesses who'd seen what he did, he was acquitted in that case. And you know, one of the agents interviewed one of the jury members afterwards just to find out what was going on back there. And the jury member said, well, we got to live down here, basically saying they knew McCall's reputation. And, you know, witnesses were being, you know, murdered in the case. And so it was one of those things where I think people knew that, like, if they wanted to see the light of day, they better just acquit Sheriff Willis McCall. And so that's what happened. He was acquitted.
Gilbert, I'm going to guess when you got that first text message that said, dude, Pulitzer, that's probably from a very close friend.
Yeah, it was an old childhood friend. And the funny thing is I was recommending Adam's book at the time. Uh-huh. So I just assumed he was telling me that Adam had won the big prize, which was true. But I had no idea that, you know, I didn't know that I was a nominee. I had just gotten a letter from the publisher saying that my book was being remaindered. In other words, it didn't sell well enough to merit keeping all the excess copies around, so they were going to start pulping them.
Oh, no.
And when they do that, they send a letter to the author saying you can buy them for like $1 a piece for all this excess inventory. And I had just gotten that letter, so I figured this book is dead. And
Then
all of a sudden, Pulitzer.
did they back off on pulping them then?
Well, it's funny because I, a couple days later, I called up and said, hey, can I still buy those copies? And they said, we'll give you 2 boxes, but that's it.
Oh, wow. That's a great story. My guest is Gilbert King. His book is Beneath a Ruthless Sun, a true story of violence, race, and justice lost and found. And you can meet Gilbert. He'll be signing copies of the book and talking about it on Wednesday evening, May 23rd, at Books & Company in Dayton. That's in the Green Shopping Center there, and that's 4453 Walnut Street, Books & Company. We'll continue with the Book Nook. We've got one more segment with Gilbert coming up right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO, and today my guest is Gilbert King. We're talking about his book, Beneath a Ruthless Sun. And this is published on the Riverhead imprint, which is a really great imprint, and I see that you had a very well-known editor working with you on this. What kind of help did she give you on this?
You know, she was great. I really so fortunate that she was working on this book, because one of the things that we discovered early on was that Richard Graham, who's the lawyer for Jesse, but he doesn't come into the story until towards the end. And, you know, we had this struggle, like, we need to get Richard Graham into this story earlier. How are we going to do that? And, you know, it's nonfiction. You can't just insert him. He's not involved in the case at all until, you know, the 1970. So what I ended up doing was just cutting a lot that was towards the front of the book. So he ends up coming into the book earlier only because we cut so much from the front. So, and that was really Becky's doing. Rebecca Salatin is the name of my editor, and she's just, you know, incredibly well-respected, award-winning authors left and right, and so easy to work with and just so honest and, you know, brutal at times. But I think the process in this particular case was there's a lot of, side stories that sort of take a circuitous route, but they're really related to this case. And so, for instance, like, there's three Supreme Court cases, all from this little town of Okahumka. And it's a population of about 300 people. And when you realize that there are three separate civil rights cases that made it to the U.S. Supreme Court, it's an interesting fact. And I had to sort of talk about those other two cases, even though they were not related, but it just gave you a better picture. And one of those cases was Virgil Hawkins, who was trying to integrate the University of Florida Law School. And he's living right next to the Knowleses, right in that little town of Okahumka. And his nephew becomes the lead suspect in this rape. And so it made perfect sense that this was Willis McCall's intent to just embarrass this family and to ruin the efforts of Virgil Hawkins to get into the University of Florida, which is before the Supreme Court. So it was related. And so it was a lot of editing down and just sort of tightening up those areas, those strings, so that you got a little bit of it, but not too much. And so that was really Becky's doing, because I tell you, as an author, you lose perspective. I just think everything's important, and I really need that outside person to say, you don't need this. And that's what a lot of our editing was like.
One of the, I think, really tragic figures in this story, and he's a criminal, but he's still tragic, is Sam Wiley Odom. And these, right. You have a picture starting each chapter, and these are very well chosen. And starting one chapter, you have his mugshot. And I kept going back as I was reading his account and looking back, and it's like he's looking right through you.
Yeah, I got to tell you, that the part of that book that really was the most powerful thing to me was these interrogations. I'll just set it up a little bit. So Jesse's sent off to Chattahoochee, but the rapes don't stop in Lake County, and they're exactly the same MO. You know, the suspect strips down to his socks, enters the house, sexually assaults a woman, and then leaves. And there's a couple of these happening, and they're still happening after Jesse is at Chattahoochee. And so Mabel Norris Reese kind of figures it out, and she's like, this sounds extremely related. And she goes up to Rayford State Prison with Pearl, Jesse's mother, and they start interviewing Sam Wiley Odom a few days before he's about to go to the electric chair. And he doesn't come out right out and say it, but he says, Jesse Daniels didn't rape Blanche Knowles. And he goes, I know who did. But he doesn't want to say him, because he's made this implicit promise to his mother that he will try to save his life and not admit to any more rapes. But you also get the sense, while he's talking to the deputies and while he's talking to Mabel, he knows all about this rape. He knows details that nobody else would know. And so he's trying to save Jesse's life, but he's also trying not to admit that he was the one that did it. And I just thought that those interviews were just so powerful, because they were so rooted in the time, and I had the exact dialogue from the transcripts. And so you sort of got a glimpse into who this kid was, you know, 18-year-old kid living in Okahumka. He knew Jesse Daniels. He knew Jesse's mother. And, you know, he's just holding this information and trying to save Jesse. It was just, I think it was such a powerful thing. If you put it in a novel, people would not believe it.
Gilbert, before we started recording this interview, I mentioned to you that I thought one of the biggest surprises in the story was Jesse's confession. And I don't want to get into the particulars of that, but I do want our listeners to know that he did, in fact, confess to committing the rape.
Right. And, you know, one of the things I think is really important is to understand Willis McCall and how he'd gotten these confessions. And, you know, he had done this in the Groveland case, in Devil in the Grove. He took 16-year-old Charles Greenlee, pulled him into his office, and put a gun to his head and turned on the tape recorder and just started asking him these very leading questions and got Charles Greenlee to admit that he actually did rape Norma Padgett. And then, you know, Greenlee later talked about it. He said, I just went back to my hotel and cried because I knew I'd sunk my case. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that was what Willis McCall did. And, you know, Jesse was on the other end of that himself. And you can imagine a 19-year-old mentally disabled kid is not going to stand up too well in an interrogation. I mean, one of the psychiatrists said this kid would have been, you could have convinced him he was the King of England in about 10 minutes. So he was very suggestible, mentally disabled. I even noticed it when I was interviewing him. If I asked him too much of a leading question, he would just say yes, or he would agree when it wasn't really true. And that was just, that's just his personality. So it wasn't too hard to get a confession out of Jesse.
By the time you started working on this particular project, the rape victim had died years ago, but I understand in the previous book that Norma Padgett was still around and you just were not able to ever get her to talk to you.
Yeah, I think that was actually my greatest regret in that book, was that she didn't talk to me, because, you know, I really felt there's some sympathetic feelings I felt towards her, because I think the men in her life really took this story from her. You know, all she had to do was, yes, agree that she'd been abducted and raped by four black men and identify them in court. But, you know, as soon as that story got put into place, it was no longer her story. It became Sheriff McCall's story. It became the prosecutor's story. It became her husband and her father's story. They were bent on revenge. They wanted a lynching. They wanted the electric chair. And I sort of felt that, you know, the 17-year-old girl could not be responsible for all of this violence. And, you know, I really wanted to just sort of get an understanding about what it was like living through this trial, two trials, actually, and being the center of attention in this small town and what that was like. I thought it would have been really illuminating for readers to just know that this, you know, this person wasn't just a one-dimensional evil person. But the problem was I had trial testimony and I had her FBI statements, and they didn't really match up 100%. And so I have to just go on what I have and newspaper reports. But she has not talked to a reporter in 70 years. Mm. And she's still living in Lake County, believe it or not. But she has not talked to a reporter since right after the first trial. And I think when she started talking to that reporter, she said a few things that didn't really match up to what she said in court. And I think she was given a warning from the sheriff or the prosecutor saying, keep your mouth closed or you're going to wind up in jail. And since then, she has not ever spoken to a reporter.
Oh, man. That's amazing. I think that when we picture southern prisons back in this period, we think of some pretty scary places. But I think the place where Jesse was incarcerated, this facility for the insane, had to be worse. Tell us about this location, this place. And the people that ran it who were cooperating with the cover-up.
You know, that's the thing. Like, when you listen to the legislators and the people in Florida, they said you were much better off in a prison because you could be locked behind bars and be safe at some extent. But Jesse was thrown in because he had a charge hanging over his head, he was thrown in with the most violent, psychopathic, you know, prisoners in Florida who were sent to a mental institute while they were, you know, to be determined whether they were sane or not. So the level of violence that was happening in these facilities with very little supervision, were just thrown in these dorm rooms, about 50 beds, and you know, the guards were no help either. They were sadistic. They were beating the patients left and right. They were, you know, there was lobotomies happening in the institute. There was shock therapy, Thorazine. They were loading up these patients on drugs, and they would just sit around drooling in stupors all day. And so this was the place that Jesse spent 14 years of his life. There were legislators saying that, you know, this is right before they started to modify and sort of really look into these mental institutes in the South, because they were just horrid places. And Jesse was there for that. And, there's no telling what he actually went through. A lot of that is not documented in the medical reports. Sometimes they left things off their reports, but he was clearly victimized in this place.
And of course, it's something that he doesn't really like to talk about, but you did discover that there was another person being held there who was secretly recording what was happening, and he was a good source for you, wasn't he?
Oh, he was phenomenal. I mean, it's just how lucky you get in this case. The man's name was Kenneth Donaldson, and he was involuntarily committed against his will to this mental institute, because back then all you really needed to do was have, like, he had his father sign a paper saying that he thought, you know, he was having mental difficulties. And once you get a judge's signature, that's it. They throw you in the mental institute. And he never got a hearing. And, you know, he was there for 15 years himself. And he recorded everything. He was constantly keeping notes, hundreds and hundreds of pages, about all his interactions with personnel and doctors. And he was clearly... He'd had some kind of emotional problems, but he wasn't insane. He didn't belong in Chattahoochee. And so finally he got released by a sympathetic superintendent of the mental health facility in the early 70s. And he immediately filed a case, and it went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it became a landmark mental health decision by the Supreme Court. He won, and he was compensated for his incarceration there.
And the governorship of Florida had changed by this time, just like the facilities were changing, the management was changing to more open-minded, more progressive people. That made a difference too, didn't it?
It really did. I mean, after Jesse got out and after Kenneth Donaldson got out, people were paying attention, and there was a legislator by the name of Maxine Baker in Florida who just said, we have to reform mental health law in this state. And, she shepherded through this, the Baker Act was named after her, which became a model for a lot of the rest of the country, uses elements of the Baker Act in their own legislation, basically saying that if you're going to incarcerate someone, they have to have a hearing and they have to have representation within 3 days. And this never happened with Jesse. Jesse just was packed away to Chattahoochee, and he was never given an opportunity to defend himself in this criminal case. And I think one of the most disturbing things in the report was the doctors who evaluated him said, he's definitely slow, but he doesn't show any signs of insanity, except for one thing. He seems to believe that there was a conspiracy to frame him for this crime. And so they were using his own, sense of reality that he did not do this act. They were using that against him. And the doctors would say his own lawyer says he was guilty.
Yeah.
And so, well, the lawyer was in on it, too. I mean, that's the level of depravity, and it was being held against Jesse.
We've decided the patient is insane because he believes he doesn't belong here.
Right. And that the doctor testified to that in a hearing, said we couldn't find anything else that was wrong with him, but he seems to be suffering from this sense of a conspiracy out to get him for a crime he didn't commit.
Oh, my.
Like, it was true.
Oh, my. My guest is Gilbert King. His book is Beneath a Ruthless Sun, A True Story of Violence, Race, and Justice Lost and Found. And you can meet Gilbert. He'll be at Books and Company on Wednesday, May 23rd at 7 o'clock in the evening to talk about the book and to sign copies of it. That's Books and Company at the Green in Beaver Creek. You have these photos that start each chapter, and just beautifully chosen photos, a couple really good ones of Sheriff Willis McCall. And as we open the book, we see a picture of the young, innocent Jesse. And then at the end, you close the book with a photo of Jesse's guitar and his teddy bear. And this is really heartbreaking.
Yeah, that was one of the things where I saw it in one of the stories, or no, it was actually in the doctor's testimony when he was writing his report. He said that Jesse admitted that he still slept with a teddy bear at night. He's a 19-year-old kid, but he's really, you think about it, he has the mind of a 10-year-old. And that was pretty obvious when I was interviewing him, that, he's very childlike in a lot of ways. And I asked him about that teddy bear, and he said, yes, I had a teddy bear. He said, I also had a baby penguin, and I slept with the baby penguin. And then he said, but it wasn't a real one. I just thought it was so heartbreaking when he tells you these stories about his childhood that he remembers so clearly. And, he, you know, he starts to smile, talking about the fishing hole where he used to go. And you know, you just realize that this kid was really locked away in the prime of his childhood because that's where his mind was.
What is his life like now?
Well, you know, after he got out, he would work as odd jobs, like a chef's helper. He did dishwashing jobs around Daytona Beach. But as he got older, he experienced some difficulties, and he needed some assistance. So he's in an assisted living facility now. About a year ago, he broke his hip, which has sort of limited his mobility, although he seems to be getting better. But his vision and his hearing is failing him. So he's definitely showing some, you know, wear and tear, I guess, with aging. He's almost 80 years old now.
Does he know you wrote a book about him?
He does. In fact, I was told that he was being treated as a celebrity at the assisted living facility because they had no idea that he was involved in this case going back to the 1950s. So I think they gave him a nicer room now, and he's being treated a little bit as a celebrity.
Good for him.
Yeah.
What a hard life. I know it takes you a long time to complete one of your writing projects, and obviously the last two have been connected. Is there something that you're looking at for the next one?
You know, I have a couple ideas that I'm working on and just doing, like, preliminary research. I think they're really good ideas. The problem is you don't really know if they're a book, if there's enough source material, and that's a lot of the problem with the stories I find. They're unbelievably interesting stories, but because there was no appellate record in court or there was no civil rights investigation, a lot of times all the people that you write about are interviewed by FBI agents. So you have, you know, very fresh, maybe a week later, you have everybody in the story telling what happened. And that's really valuable in piecing together these stories. But if you don't have a civil rights investigation, sometimes you only have newspaper articles or if you could track down family members. So it's just not as complete. I have a couple ideas that I'm looking into that are very much, you know, in line with the kind of work I seem to be doing a lot of, which is, you know, that pre-civil rights movement area right before the 60s. And they're stories that I think are really good and worth telling. I just don't know if I have enough primary source. So I'm filing all these Freedom of Information Act requests and seeing what turns up.
Why are you so passionate about this?
You know, I think to me the reason that these stories resonate with me is because they're great injustices. And a lot of times it's these young lawyers who are out front of the civil rights movement. All the advances that were being made in civil rights were in the courts before the protests of the 60s came along. So all the progress you see are done by these civil rights lawyers who just believe in this. Many, many times it's wrongly accused people of crimes that are just being railroaded off. And most of them can't fight back. But sometimes you get a lawyer or a journalist along and just says, this isn't right, and I'm going to do everything within my power to see that justice is had. And so I find that these are great American stories of American heroes. And, you know, sometimes the journalists don't get a fair shake, and lawyers definitely don't get a fair shake. And so I like to point to areas where real progress and real aid has been given to some of these victims of injustices. And a lot of times it was just lawyers and journalists.
Well, Gilbert, it's really been a pleasure having you on the program.
Oh, thanks for having me, Vic. I really appreciate it.